to Live from the Festival here on BCB 106.6 FM, coming to you from the Bradford Literature Festival Hub here in City Park. I'm Carol Moss.
I'm Kath Webber.
And I'm June Russell, and we'll be with you for the next 30 minutes bringing you all the Literature Festival news, reviews and interviews. On today's programme, we'll be hearing from Manny Coe, who'll be at the festival on Thursday evening with his brother Reuben, talking about their book, Brother, Do You Love Me?
And very shortly, we'll be joined by Colin Philpott and Sarah Tarlow, who are part of tonight's festival event, A Good Death, at the Dye House in Bradford College. But first, let's have a quick chat about the festival so far. Well, I spent this afternoon listening to Tim Smith and looking at his photography, where he was talking about his connections with the Ukrainian community here in Bradford and his visits to Ukraine over the decades, which was brilliant. I really loved it. Really interesting.
And I have had a day off today, but I spent yesterday morning and lunchtime in the Dye House Gallery boiling, listening to J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis academics talking about their work and their friendship. It's really good.
And I popped into the Lunch Bite today to see Nigel Grizzard talking about the Jewish community in Calderdale, but mentioning quite a lot of the Jewish community here in Bradford. So just an indication of the range of stuff we've got here tonight.
As ever, the variety is just amazing, isn't it? There's always too much to choose from.
There is, but we've got some good guests on tonight, and we're going to get a real taste of what's coming up.
Yes, so we have. We've got Colin Philpott and Sarah Tarlow. Hello, Colin.
Hello.
And Sarah.
Hi.
And Colin's doing a bit of a double act over the next 24 hours on the festival. You're doing a conversation in your own right about your involvement with cricket and developments in that area, and then you're going to have a conversation with Sarah around the, well, interest to you, because you've written a book about this, but Sarah particularly has just been writing and publishing a book which looks really at the role and the way in which death is held in our society, Sarah.
That's right. Yeah. So I came at this from two different points of view. First of all, I'm an academic. I'm a professor of archaeology, and I've always specialised in the archaeology of death and burial over the years. But a few years ago, my husband sadly became very ill and then passed away. So the book that I've written combines memoir of his illness and death with reflections from my professional experience as an archaeologist who specialises in that area.
A really powerful combination of your experiences then.
Well, I hope so. Yes, I hope it isn't too harsh. You know, I think it's got humour in it as well. And
I think it is an area that increasingly people are becoming more prepared to talk about and to think about. And we are, you know, genuinely exploring different ways of meeting the reality of our own deaths and dealing with the deaths of those around us. I think it's a really important area. And Colin, you wrote a book a little while ago, which was a futuristic fiction, I believe.
Yes, I mean, Sarah's book, which I've read and which is a very, very moving and powerful book, you know, it's based on some real life experience. I mean, my book is a novel, it's a work of fiction, although it is based on personal experiences, you know, have sort of family experiences of end of life, of family, close family members, but also I volunteer with a food delivery charity. And therefore, you know, but it's more than just the food, it's a befriending thing as well. I've met loads and loads of, you know, quite seriously old people in their 80s and well into their 90s. And that's sort of made me think a lot more about all of this. Yeah, and the book, without, you know, spoiler alert, the book basically is envisages England in 2045, where euthanasia has become compulsory for people when they reach the age of 90. Not something I'm advocating, I have to add. It's just a scenario for getting into a bit of a discussion about all of that. And as you said, I think the point of having this event tonight, it might sound a bit gloomy. Why would people want to come and sit in a room for an hour and discuss death on a sort of summer's evening? But actually, I think it is part of something which I think is going on, which is people being a bit more open about it and prepared to talk about death and sort of regard death as, in a sense, being part of life rather than something that we all just try and sweep under the carpet. And I've certainly noticed, I don't know if this is an indication, I've happened to have been to quite a lot of funerals in the last year, and a lot of them feel much more celebratory, I suppose is the right word, than I think funerals used to be, which I would say, I mean, obviously it depends on the circumstances and how old a person is when they die, but, you know, overall I think that seems to me to be a good thing. And I suppose we're slightly trying to reflect that this evening in terms of having a discussion where people can talk more openly about death and some of the things that people might be able to do. Okay, some people don't get the choice of knowing when they might be about to die, of course, but I suppose a lot of people do in a way, and it's how people can prepare for that and maybe prepare in a more positive way rather than just sort of, this isn't going to happen.
Yes, this idea of a good death, which I guess is part of what you explore in your work.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's hugely important that we should be having these conversations around death, and that we should be having them with our friends, with our family, and books like Colin's, and I hope mine, I hope I will be a kind of catalyst to help have those kinds of conversations so that we can discuss what we want for ourselves, what we hope for each other, and create an environment where we can all have a good death as far as possible, which crowns and rounds off a good life.
And the idea that, I mean, the inevitability of it has to be kind of accepted and in a sense welcomed, and as you say, given a shape that we can have some part in.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We all know this, no matter how much salad we eat, no matter how much jogging we do. It's coming for us. We all know how this story ends. But we should be able to shape it where possible so that we can end it well.
And do you think from the archaeology side of the work that you've done that you've observed maybe a greater acceptance of that? I mean, it's very hard to know, isn't it, going back hundreds, thousands of years. But do you think it was embedded more in people's lives than perhaps we have done in the last 50 years or so?
Oh, undoubtedly. In some cultures, you see, for example, in Neolithic Turkey, where they would bury the dead under the floor of the house that they lived in. So you can see that the dead were very much more a part of everyday life. But I think one of the things I love about archaeology is that it just gives you a range of possibilities and shows you how variable the human response to death has been and can be. So it makes you question some of the things that you take for granted and realize that things could be different, things could be otherwise.
It's interesting. I think in a way there's almost a parallel between the way that we've begun to challenge the accepted rules and regulations about birth at the same time as challenging the accepted ways of dealing with death. So there's more challenge, there's more possibility, there's more openness and difference maybe.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Almost, you know, every few months you hear, don't you, about somewhere in the world which has in some shape or form legalized, you know, be careful about the terminology here, voluntary euthanasia, assisted dying, assisted suicide. They all mean slightly different things. But one thing that certainly, you know, I have not studied this in an academic way, in the way that Sarah has, but just writing the book and talking to lots of people has made me think about, you know, whether the law should be changed. And there is, I think, a bit of a momentum, and people will know that quite a few high profile people like Prue Leith and others are associated with the Campaign for Dignity in Dying. And I think there are a few things going on. There's a committee of MPs which is looking at the laws at the moment, expected to report quite soon. So I think there is a bit of a momentum about, you know, discussing this more openly and, you know, thinking about whether we can, in certain circumstances, with lots of safeguards in place, give people a bit more control of the end of lives at the end of their lives in certain circumstances. So I think it's an interesting time to be discussing all this.
And then, as you say, Sarah, the ways in which people mark a death, the ways in which they celebrate a life, I think there's change afoot there as well, isn't there?
Yes, I think there are. And it is part of that whole conversation, and we're becoming better at having those conversations. I think we've still got a way to go before, as you mentioned earlier, the parallel between the way that birth is arranged in our society and the way that death is. And I think there's still a bit of a way to go to feel as supported at the end of life as we do at the beginning. But yes, I hope that by considering a range of possibilities from archaeology, from history, from anthropology, from fiction, we can have those conversations.
I think it's interesting also that the idea of the death cafe, I'm not sure, you probably will have written about this in your book, but this is a new kind of idea, isn't it? Again, to encourage the openness, to bring people perhaps who've experienced loss, but who may be thinking of that for themselves as well. Have you got something to say about the death cafe?
Yes, actually, I arranged one with Professor Karina Croucher from the University of Bradford and another colleague of ours who works for a hospice in Leicester, where I'm based. Mm-hmm. And we arranged an exhibition on the archaeology and the history of death as a way to focus conversations at a death cafe at a series of exhibitions in Leicester a few years ago.
It may be something that our listeners are not familiar with, but I know there was a short period of time when there was one in Bradford. I don't think that currently is going, but...
I wasn't really aware of death cafes until a year or so ago, and I sort of assumed they were for people who'd already been given some sort of terminal diagnosis, but they're not. I mean, they may include people who fall into that category, but actually it's about just all of us at various stages of our life having the sort of discussions that Sarah's talked about, which, you know, we don't want to sort of over-focus on it, do we? But I think it, if people were more open about it and just more matter-of-fact in a sense about it, I think it would help all of us in the long term.
Perhaps taking back from the kind of medical profession the control over this area, which is something that's so emotional and important to all families, really.
Yes, I think so. And if we can have those conversations, take the heat out of them a little bit by making them a bit more familiar and a bit less medical. But I think it's also important that we do engage medical professionals and clinicians as well, because they're a really key part of the way we die today.
And also perhaps having an impact on the training of medics, because that is an area where perhaps they've not been given the skills that they would need to make those connections with family and the individual who's facing that end of life. So we're going to be having the opportunity this evening at the Die House Dance Studio. Sarah and Colin will be talking with Professor Andrew Doig, looking at this whole idea of a good death. That's this evening. And then tomorrow, Sarah, you're talking with Clover Stroud about Stories of Life, Love and Loss, which is your book.
It's unfortunately, Clover is not able to attend tomorrow, so I'll be talking with Claire Shaw, who's a poet.
Thank you very much indeed. So that's at Waterstones. And then Colin, you've got another interest, another strand to your...
Completely unrelated to the subject here. We're doing an event here in the main festival hub, actually, at lunchtime at 12 o'clock tomorrow, called Centuries of Cricket. And basically, it's looking at aspects of the history of cricket in Bradford. I mean, people think cricket in Yorkshire, people think of Headingley and all of that. But actually, Yorkshire used to play lots of matches, as many people know, at Park Avenue in Bradford. There's a fascinating history of that place, and there's a fantastic plan for redeveloping it so that it could host first-class cricket, and with a particular emphasis, actually, on developing women's cricket and cricket for people from minority communities. And what could be more appropriate, given the news today, this damning report about cricket and various aspects of cricket, which clearly need changing. And the sort of work that a number of us are involved with, including Bradford Council, actually the England and Wales Cricket Board are a partner in this project in Bradford, Yorkshire County Cricket Club, and the Yorkshire Cricket Foundation, which is the charity associated with Yorkshire Cricket, which I'm a trustee of. Those groups of people are involved in developing Park Avenue, and it's a really good example, I would suggest, of what cricket clearly needs to do a lot more of. I mean, we've all known that for a while, but today's report highlights that even more, that there's a lot of work to do to make it a game which really is available to anybody who wants to play it.
So that's the lunch bite, Centuries of Cricket in Bradford, and that's tomorrow at 12.
I'll be joined, actually, for that by Mr. Park Avenue himself, who many of your listeners will know, Nasser Hussain, who's the groundsman at Park Avenue, but he's a lot more than the groundsman. He's the sort of vision for the place.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. That would be really, really interesting for people who want to go along to the... that's here at the Festival Hub tomorrow at 12 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed. So, cricket and a good death. Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you very much, Colin. It's been really good to chat with you. All the very best for your events and with the book and any books that are out there in the future. It sounds like there's going to be a few more. Thank you ever so much, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Wow, fascinating. Both of those interesting in just very, very different ways, isn't it, Kath?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of interesting conversations provoked by the chat this evening and then by Sarah's talk tomorrow. So that's really good, really interesting.
What do you make of that, Julie?
Well, I'm going to both of them. So I'm looking forward to both. I mean, at my age, our age, it's something you start to think about more. And I think about...
What's that, cricket?
No, not cricket. Sadly. But not sadly, but, you know, not sadly at all. I found that I think about it as life goes by more optimistically than I used to do when I was young, to be honest. Because as you get nearer, you have to be practical. And therefore, you have to think about it in practical and... I don't know, what's the word for it, really?
matter of fact, sort of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think obviously as we get older, we've had more personal experiences of loss.
Yes.
You know, our parents, partners, maybe brothers, sisters. But I think what's interesting is where a lot of younger people are taking this on. I know my daughter, who's 32, has several friends who've experienced loss, not just of parents, but sometimes of siblings. And there's a real openness to share and to talk about the experience of grieving amongst her group, and I think this is something that is really to be welcomed.
I think that really is new, because when we were young, that did not happen, did it? I mean, you just did not talk about it, you didn't discuss it. It was something that was too horrible. You didn't want to think about it. And I think you do need to think about it, and it's not so bad when you do.
It isn't, and that's why you mentioned about the medical profession, because sometimes the medical profession, they're humans like the rest of us, and they don't like to think about dying, especially when it's their job to look after and make people better.
It's a sort of sense of failure if you lose one, isn't there? Yes, yeah. I can understand that, yeah.
And I, well, thinking about Colin's approach, thinking about euthanasia, it's obviously a very emotive point, and people do need to start thinking about that and the implications of that. And we've got some examples from elsewhere in the world, but I think putting it in fiction is quite a nice way of airing those thoughts.
Yes, and creating characters who have to deal with either their impending euthanasia as they reach 90, which apparently where it's set in that fiction. I'm not sure that 90 is the place I'd set it, but anyway, it sounds like a really interesting way of approaching it, doesn't it? Yeah.
I think one of the problems people have with the idea of euthanasia, and this worries me about just getting old, is that there's a moment in your age where people start to believe that you have no agency, you know, that you're too old to have an opinion. You know, and they look after you.
Well, fortunately, we're not too
we're
old
not
to have
getting
opinions.
There yet. We're not there yet.
Here on BCB
Radio.
We're
full of opinions.
And I think it's ready to time to go on to our next item.
So, Manico, with his brother Reuben, is coming to the Bradford Literature Festival on Thursday to talk about their new book, Brother, Do You Love Me? This was written during a particularly difficult time when COVID kept families apart. BCB's Carol Moss talked to Manny and started by asking him to explain the title of the book.
The title came from a text message that Reuben sent to me. Reuben's my youngest brother. We're four boys and he's the youngest. And he was in a desperate state in a care home in Dorset, and I was trapped in Spain during the pandemic. I've lived in Spain for 23 years, and I knew Reuben was bad, but I didn't realize just how bad he was. And one day out of the blue in November 2020, he sent me that text. It simply said, "Brother, do you love me?"
That must have been an incredible moment for you.
Yeah, because Reuben knows I love him, so I knew it wasn't a question. It was him trying to communicate to me that he needed help. I saw it as an SOS, as a come and get me, I don't know how much longer I can hold on for.
Your story about what happened since that text has been a journey that has amazed people. Why do you think it's touched that chord?
I think so many people relate to it. You don't have to have a sibling with Down syndrome to read and love Brother, Do You Love Me? It touches so many chords because we all lived through our own pandemic, and many people suffered isolation. It wasn't just, it was old people, it was young people, it was across the board. And we all remember that terrible time when we couldn't get to our loved ones. And when someone like Reuben, whose mental health was already vulnerable, and that feeling of desperation when I couldn't get to him, I think everybody has been through that to some degree, and so they can relate. Everybody lived their own COVID story, and this is just one of hundreds of thousands. So people can really relate to it because they can understand Reuben's isolation and his need for contact, and that's where the message came from.
Did the people in the home where he was in the care home, did they pick up on his distress?
He was already in a vulnerable place before he went in. He'd suffered a breakdown in September 2018, so I'm not going to say everything was on the care home because that's not true. He was already vulnerable and delicate when he went in, but he began to spiral quite quickly. The thing is that as much as I tried to communicate to them that this wasn't the normal Rubes, that's the only Rubes that they'd ever known, so they had nothing to compare it to. So they kept saying to me, he's fine, he's fine, he's very quiet, but he's fine. And when I get that text message, I realize that he really isn't fine. Rube's communication works on a different way to ours. His words are indicators. I call them road signs. Once you learn the meaning, you react to them. And his communication is not as fluid as ours might be. So when I get those five words, brother, do you love me? I know that they're coming from a place of deep worry and deep concern. And for him to, he rarely asks for anything. He's so undemanding. And so I saw that as a real plea for help. You know, he was in a desperate state, bless him. He was pretty much isolated. The care home took the hard line, which most care homes did back then. He was isolated in his room for up to 20, 22 hours a day. His television wasn't connected. His only outlet really was DVDs and films. During his isolation, he crossed over into his fantasy world of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Whoopi Goldberg and all the films he loves. And he'd crossed over to that fantasy world, and I had to join him in that fantasy world to try and bring him back to reality.
Your book, Brother, Do You Love Me, has had quite a lot of success, and I think because it touches the very things that you said. Have you been surprised about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We remember the bleak old days of that Dorset winter when we were both really struggling to find each other and find a new path for Ruben's future. I was writing, he was drawing. When he was nonverbal, he was drawing every day. So all of a sudden, the narrative started to build, and I saw a correlation between what he was illustrating and what the story I was trying to tell. So yeah, it's really important to remember that all of the illustrations for the book were drawn by Ruben, even the front cover. And it's his view. It's a nighttime view of the care home where he was isolated for months and months, and that's what he was looking at. And in his memory, obviously, he spent so long there looking out of that window, wondering where everybody was, where I was, where his family were, where his friends were, where his life was. And it's a really pondering front cover. I think it's very powerful.
So you're coming up to Bradford, to the Bradford Literature Festival.
Yay.
And you've got a paperback coming out in September, but you've also got an audiobook. How's that going to work?
Well, the audiobook will probably be published at a similar time as the paperback. The publishers asked me if I wanted to record it, and I responded positively. I've never recorded anything before, but I felt that there's such an intimate story. And, you know, as brothers, we tease each other and we mimic each other. And so in the book, I play with Rubes, and I'm never laughing at him ever. I'm always laughing with him. But I felt that for any actor to cross over to that boundary of intimacy, into that intimacy, might be quite complicated for someone to get their head around. So it made perfect sense that I read it. And then they got Rubes into the studio, and he recorded his parts as well. So whenever there's a drawing in the manuscript, you'll hear Ruben's voice. And I think the result is quite powerful.
And what actually prompted you to write the book?
Good question. I was writing something else, actually, another book, which I've just finished. And I had to park that for a long time because Ruben and I were living something quite extraordinary. 26 weeks we spent together in a cottage in Dorset. I remember describing it as Ruben being a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that someone had dropped. And it was my job to collect all those pieces, make sure they were all the right way up, and then somehow rebuild his internal jigsaw. That's when I started writing, when I realized that we were living something that probably would never happen again. Hopefully it will never happen again. And I started writing it on the 5th of February, right in the middle of our time together. So towards the end of our 26 weeks together, I was writing in real time. And so the first draft was a bit of a Dear Kitty confessional style. And then the manuscript grew from there.
And it's a very personal journey. Were you worried about making it such a personal journey?
Yes. I was worried about making myself vulnerable, and I think that's another part of the story that people really relate to, is because I'm very honest. I describe myself as Ruben's brother, warts and all, and I'm not the perfect brother. I'm not the perfect carer. And there were parts of the story that were very dark, and when I failed him. And so I think that honesty and raw truth is what people really related to, and were very grateful to hear that they were not only the carer that loses patience, or the carer that shouts at their son or their daughter or their son. It's just human nature. You know, we all have our limits. And Ruben and I's situation, it did stretch us to our limits. And that's all bared in the book.
And how do you think Ruben will cope with being at the festival itself, the Literature Festival?
He's excited. I spoke to him about it yesterday. Last year for the hardback publication, we did a 6-week book tour of England and Wales and 16 dates, and I could see his confidence growing. Yeah, it's been wonderful. Just going to events for Rubes 2 years ago, I would have thought that pretty much impossible. He didn't want to go out, didn't want to relate to anybody, definitely didn't want to talk in public. But now he's beginning to shine. You know, this book has been the return of his voice, the return of his pride. And I think those that come to the event in Bradford, you'll see that. You'll see our dynamic as brothers, and you'll see him. He's not back to the way he used to be, because he was a very gregarious out there performer. We haven't got Rubes, the old Rubes back. We've got a new Rubes back. But the new Rubes is just as cool as the old Rubes. So I'm so happy to have him back in the room.
And I'm sure that the people of Bradford will give him the welcome that
amazing.
Thank you very much, Manny. Look forward
absolute
to
absolute pleasure. We yeah. can't wait to be up there. And just incidentally, we're from Yorkshire. We're all born in Leeds. And I haven't been to Bradford since I was 12 years old. And I'm now pushing 50. So I'm very excited to be back in your wonderful city.
And that was Manny Coe talking to BCB's Carol Moss about Brother Do You Love Me. And Manny and Ruben will be at Waterstones this Thursday, 29th of June at 7:30.
And we're joined here in the Bradford Festival Hub by Tim Smith, who's been talking today about the Ukrainian community and started actually taking photographs of the community in the 1980s. And you've done an event today, and you've got stories from Ukraine, and you must find the work now very different from the work that you did back in the 80s.
Well, it is and it isn't, in that the talk that I was giving today is very much about how the reasons why the Ukrainian community in Bradford, who first came over 75 years ago, their experiences of the Soviet Union and what was happening in their part of the world, it just really kind of mirror what's going on there now. So, yes, things have changed, but sadly, history is kind of repeating itself, in that a lot of what Putin and Russia are doing is trying to reassert their authority over that part of the world.
And what are your photographs? What are you trying to do when you photograph people? Are you trying to sort of capture the community?
Well, I suppose my job as a photographer is to attempt to make interesting images, you know, pictures that engage you, but also the content of those pictures kind of tells a story and amplifies the story of those Ukrainians or whichever community it is that I'm kind of engaged with and talking to and collaborating with.
And as one of the audience this afternoon, Tim, I would say you really do that. And what your images also do is to provoke questions, because obviously you have got a whole lot of background to each image. So when somebody looks at it without that, there's all sorts of things that they want to know. And I think the conversation that can be provoked by your pictures is really, really valuable. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, a photograph or a set of pictures or an exhibition or a talk even is a kind of catalyst for provoking questions. And I don't think a picture ever provides a definitive answer. You know, it depends what kind of picture it is. But different photographers can go to exactly the same event and come away with very different pictures that tell different stories. So. And often a good picture is about asking interesting questions rather than providing definitive answers.
Fantastic. And as you say, Tim Smith's pictures always do that. They're very provocative, aren't they?
They really do.
Thanks, Tim, for telling us about your event today. And we're coming towards the end of the programme. And it's been good down here in the Festival Hub. We've met Sarah Tarlow and Colin Philpott, who are on tonight. And it's goodbye from me, Carol Moss.
And from me, June Russell.
And goodbye from me, Kath Webber.
And we'll be back tomorrow at 5:30.